I was looking on the list of symposia outside. I noticed the title that this August symposium that was Symposium on Missing Data Problems. Not a bad title for this symposium, I think. The other thing is I noticed that there are two employers that are assigned to me, one in the program and one on my badge. And the Sloan Kettering Institute of Research is actually not my employer. And I come from the Memorial Hospital, also known as Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. These are sister institutions, which means they have the same, paid by the same money from the Sloan and Kettering families, and more recently, whoever is on the board of directors. It is a distinction which is important because it's related to a disclaimer I wanted to make before I start all this, mainly to the effect that I wanted to let you know that my mortgage payment does not depend on grants. Therefore, I don't have any vested interest in what I'm going to say next, other than a pragmatic interest in really obtaining or devising a better treatment for patients. So I'm coming from the clinical side of applications of the kind of problems that we are discussing here. And most of the treatments that I am associated with have to do with brachytherapy. And for those of you who do not know what brachytherapy is, basically, it's a form of radiation treatment in which radioactive sources are being inserted either directly in the tumor or in body cavities adjacent to the tumor or on the surfaces, again, adjacent to the tumors. And it is important to mention this because unlike external beam therapy, which was discussed yesterday, in braking therapy there are fewer dosimetric problems and fewer yet problems of such things as organ motion or setup errors, and these were described efforts to improve these problems in external beam were described yesterday. But of course here, if the organ moves, the sources of radiations will move with the organ. So dosimetry is not at all a problem in brachytherapy. In fact, dosimetry per se, I consider it to be a rather closed subject. I don't think there is much to be learned in dosimetry. We still have a problem, which is really an engineering problem, of delivering the type of treatment that we devised, but there are new devices, and the companies that deal with this, Varian, Siemens, they keep inventing new things that will help us indeed place the sources of radiation exactly where we want them to be. So there is yet another difference which makes brachytherapy special, which is that unlike external beam, in brachytherapy you can actually see exactly where the radiation sources have been placed. Radiation therapy, basically you design a plan, you look on the computer screen, you like the plan and you say let's go ahead, but there is no way, no real way to verify where the radiation actually went. In brachytherapy, you can visualize the sources and reconstruct completely the dosimetry and what happened during the treatment, which gives you a very good idea of what is it that you want to do. So these are important and nice tools that we have to deliver the kind of dose we wish to deliver to the tumor. Now, so The kind of things I'm going to describe here come simply from my desire to improve the treatments, improve the outcome really of the kind of treatments that we deliver. Perhaps many of you do not know that, but in fact, most treatments in radiation therapy are palliative. They are not curative treatments. There are only two exceptions to this, and I find it interesting that when I discuss this notion with radiation oncologists, they all seem to agree that this is indeed the case. There does seem to be agreement as to which are the two exceptions, but that brings us to the notion of cure. What is it that, how do we define cure in radiation oncology, and perhaps in general, and what can we do to improve the outcome of this of the patient? So this question, the distribution of clonogens surviving radiation therapy, is certainly at the core of what we call a cure. We simply want to destroy all the tumor cells. Before we go into that, it is important to understand what is the current approach to defining cure. And it is currently theoretical or modeling calculations towards this problem start from the assumption that the definition of cure means that at the end of the treatment, which is here time T, at the end of the treatment, there will be no tumor cells left alive. Zero, here means zero tumor cells, and so the probability that you have zero tumor cells is indeed one. This will be a successful treatment. Of course, this will be a successful treatment. The question is this what we really want, what we really define as cure? And many of you will immediately argue, perhaps, that a better definition is that there will be no detectable tumor during the rest of your life. Maybe that's what we should call cure, which is a much less stringent requirement than this particular requirement right here. Now, here is a list of possible objections to this definition, and this is what I already mentioned, that infinity means the end of the life of that particular person. Indeed, there is no way that we know today of observing that all the tumor cells have been killed, so this is not an observable quantity, this particular probability. The only observable quantity, the one that is quoted in all the papers, is the presence or absence of a detectable tumor at a particular time. So much of what I'm going to say will go towards improving or extending this definition in a way that we take into account the notion of a detectable tumor and also the time evolution of this particular detection process. Clearly, things that have to do with cell proliferation. So, in order to calculate the tumor, what we call the tumor control probability, TCP, the way this is done right now is by considering, first of all, the survival probability of cells after a dose D delivered in a certain temporal pattern, for instance, fractionation, taking into account the initial number of malignant cells, and then if this is true, the product of N times S of D is the average number of malignant cells left in the tumor after dose D. Furthermore, and this is an important assumption, the assumption is made that the number of surviving clonogens following radiation is Poisson distributed. Therefore, the probability of being left with any particular number of cells, cancer cells, is given by usual Poisson distribution. And if you are interested in the probability of having zero cells left at the end, you just take the usual e to the minus average number of cells left, which is n times s of d. Two questions are, first of all, is the Poisson assumption as with regards to the distribution of clonogens correct? And we know that this is actually not correct. Second question is, under what conditions will this assumption be useful? Because it is indeed a very easy way to mechanistically implement some of these calculations. And there are many, many situations in which, under which this assumption will be correct. One of them is, for instance, when the number of cells involved or left is rather large, if this is indeed the case. Now, I believe it was Howard, in fact, that was perhaps the first one to demonstrate and show by a certain calculations that the Poisson approximation is not actually valid. It is possible to show this based on first principles in a very rigorous way. In fact, this was known for at least 50, 60 years, and we keep rediscovering many things. Now, nevertheless, this equation, this Poisson equation, has been used and is being used extensively in radiation oncology, probably 99.9% of all calculations. And there are a number of interesting things that come out of this. For instance, if you take clinical data and you wish to make a fit of this expression to the clinical data, one of the strange things that comes out of this is that this N, which is the initial number of cancer cells before treatment, comes out almost invariably as being a very, very small number, unexpectedly small number. Sometimes maybe 10 or 100, something of this order. And this was, of course, in a certain sense taken as an indication that something is not quite right. And there have been a number of explanations proposed for this. But it is also possible, and I happen to subscribe to this idea, that it is possible that the fate of the tumor, whether we succeed in destroying all the tumor cells, depends in fact on a very small number of cells that happen to be very radio resistant or fast proliferating or both. The kind of doses we deliver in radiation therapy are actually absolutely huge. I mean, it is very unlikely that the kind of cells we know from lab studies will actually survive this kind of doses. So it could very well be that there is one particular subfraction of cells that in fact determine the fate of our treatment. And in fact, current efforts in what is called functional imaging, which is the ability to detect these peculiar cells, this may be the solution to the kind of treatments. If we could actually spatially identify where these cells are, perhaps, and this is a hypothesis right now, perhaps this will help us understand how to do better treatments. But there is something else. If indeed this is the case, then then we don't have to apologize, as it happened yesterday, so much for our models being too simple or not taking account. Maybe the models should be indeed simple because we are dealing with a particular population of cells, and in what follows, this will be a simple approach by assuming indeed that there are certain parameters that characterize this population. And one possible justification for this is indeed the presence of one such subpopulation which ultimately determines what happens. So this is the Poisson approach, and again, these are reasons why you could explained already. I was also using Poisson approach all the time without really thinking too much about its validity, until I had to do this in the case of brachytherapy, and then things suddenly I noticed that something is not quite right with this. What happens in brachytherapy? For instance, in a prostate implant, you implant in the prostate radioactive seeds, and they will decay. So basically, the dose is delivered over the remainder of the lifetime of that patient. So here you have a dose. The dose rate will decrease according to the decay constant of that particular isotope. And at the same time as the dose is being delivered in a decreasing manner, cells continue to proliferate, tumor cells, while being exposed to radiation. Now, if you work out the mathematics of this, so one can calculate what is the dose delivered up to a certain time t. Of course, since the, say, iodine-125, which is one such isotope, half-life is about 60 days. So after approximately 1 year, most of the dose would have been delivered anyhow. So you have this equation as a function of initial dose rate, how many seeds you implant. And if you go through all this mathematics of the Poisson model, you end up concluding that in fact you can never actually cure a tumor using this particular procedure because of this interplay between continuous cell proliferation and, on the other hand, the dose decaying and over the same amount of time and eventually. So there are conceptual problems with these models that have to be addressed and fixed. So, going back to the stochastics of cell proliferation, and this is classical stuff that is being described in almost any book on stochastic stochastic problems. So we go back and we formulate an equation of cell proliferation based on the birth rate of the cells. So this is B here, and the rate of cell death of the same cells. And these are, of course, things that have been treated again for 40, 50 years by now. You set up this equation, and in this equation, P sub I is the probability that at a given time there are I cells around as a result of these processes. And this is simply taking into account different processes by which cells can appear or disappear, or perhaps nothing happens. And when this equation is set up, you end up with a differential equation relating the this P sub I at a time t to what happens to P sub I minus 1, P sub I when no change occurs, and P sub I plus 1. All these things are well known. The equation has been solved. I wanted also to point out that the rate of cell birth is in fact related to a quantity that is often measured in cellular biology, so can be actually estimated. And this is logarithm of 2 over what is called T pot, is the potential doubling time of cells. That means doubling time of cells, taking into account only the fraction of cells that actually divide in a population. Likewise, the ratio between, now the cell death, it's expressed, and this is the difference, that this is the new thing here, as a sum of a radiation factor, which is H of T, that we have to calculate, what is the contribution of radiation in killing cells, plus a factor D, which is not related to radiation. It's a background factor, the cell death not due to radiation. The ratio D over B, it's known as the cell loss factor, and this is quite high, 80%, 90% in a tumor. So many cells following division, they just disappear. They do not make it to the next round. But in addition to that, we have this this radiation-related factor, and now we have to calculate and add to the calculation this particular factor, and then solve the entire equation. Now, the equation has been solved. We know what the solution is. Simply have to correct the cell death rate to the effect, for the effects of radiation. And this is done here. This H, there are many ways to look at this, can be interpreted, H of D, as the probability that a clonogenic cell alive at time D will be killed during the next irradiation interval, delta D or delta T, those being related to time. And this is, of course, the definition of a hazard function in survival analysis. And to calculate that, we need the survival probability. There are a number of expressions that are being employed in radiation biology for survival probability. The most popular one right now is the so-called linear quadratic equation, which assumes that one can express survival probability as an exponential to a polynomial of second degree. These two coefficients are positive constants, and this is the dose. They have actually a mechanistic interpretation. This second one is related to the dose rate. It will change with the dose rate. And the first one is independent of dose rate, but as was explained yesterday, depends on radiation quality, the kind of radiation. So these are well understood mechanisms, and well, it takes that and from that calculates the hazard function in the usual way and ends up with this expression representing the contribution to the rate of cell death coming from radiation, which is alpha plus 2 beta D multiplied by the dose rate. And you go back to your equation. And let's assume for the moment, we're going to relax this assumption, but for the moment, let's work under the assumption that TCP, tumor control probability, it's indeed the probability to end up with zero cells at a given time T. Again, currently this is taken the end of the treatment. And if we do that, you've seen this generating function yesterday. That's the way to solve the equation. You build up this function. Turns out that it satisfies this particular differential equation, which can be solved. The advantage of this generating function is that, of course, you can calculate by differentiating this function the probability of ending up with any number of clonogens at any given time. And this is indeed, this is the title of what I wanted to describe, and this comes straight from this. So if you have a solution for this generating function, then you have the entire distribution, and you can figure out what happens also as a function of time. In particular, this tumor control probability is the generating function taken at s equals 0 and whatever time you are interested to look at. Here is the expression. It's a rather simple analytic expression, very easy to program and to work out. N is the initial number of tumor cells. So this is one number that you must know or obtain from the data. S of t is the survival probability at time t. It's B minus D is the difference between the birth and death rate. And you have some integral here and all this expression. One thing to note about this is that unlike deterministic approach to this problem, where the solution depends exclusively on the difference between the birth date and the death rate, this is the Malthusian growth. Unlike that, if you do it stochastically, you can see that the birth rate comes here as an independent factor. So both constants are important, and they are independent. They independently contribute to this. And this is a significant difference when you analyze the data. Now, if at time t, if at the end of the treatment, you still have clonogens alive, you can continue your calculation and ask what is the probability that a certain number of months, let's say after treatment, you end up with zero clonogens. And this is obtained by this particular equation. C is the number of clonogens left alive. Ultimately, at the limit, and this is a well-known result from stochastic processes, the final limit of this process is the ratio of the death rate to the birth rate to the power of the number of clonogens left. So this is the ultimate limit of this particular tumor control probability. Cannot do better than that under these conditions. Now, you can also write a complete solution for this for any time following treatment, and this just becomes a little bit more complicated. Note that I took the birth rate and the death rate as constants, but there is absolutely no problem if you are interested in logistic models, Gompertzian models, things like that. You simply replace that by functions of time, and it's easy to incorporate this. Since you have to do this numerically anyhow, it really doesn't make any big difference, except that you end up with one or two more parameters. But it's completely general and can treat the problem in complete generality. Again, the assumption here, and this is an important assumption, is that somehow you can characterize this process by one single set of parameters. So in fact, you are treating a very homogeneous problem, and I took some further encouragement that this idea may not be entirely incorrect from Howard's book, in which they did analysis. They were able to show that the certain results concerning tumor cure probability can be well characterized in terms of single parameters, alpha and beta, for instance. So it is possible, apparently, to use single, maybe effective parameters to describe such processes. We'll stick to that for the moment, simply because there doesn't seem to be a need at this time to be more complicated than that. All right. Now, immediate application of this will be to a situation where you deliver the dose in daily fraction, and most treatments are done this way. And then here is your surviving probability, which is after one fraction S sub zero. This is for after a dose of typically 2 gray of radiation. And of course, after the second fraction is the square of that, and so on. Because the time interval between fractions is 1 day, most repair processes are complete by one day. So you can consider the cells as brand new. The cells will have no memory of what happened before in the previous fraction, and the new surviving fraction will be the square of that. And you can continue until you deliver the entire number of fractions, maybe 30 fractions F. In this particular case, you can actually integrate that equation, and you end up with a relatively simple, saying relatively simple because it's not as simple as the Poisson equation, but a relatively simple equation that describes this tumor control probability, in this case, at the end of the treatment. In particular, when you have a single fraction, you end up with the binomial equation, which becomes very close to the Poisson equation for a single fraction. But this expression is quite different from the result that you would obtain under the Poisson assumption. Let me say just a few words about tumor growth and introduce this type of terminology that it's common in radiation biology, perhaps not so much in mathematical modeling, but these things are related, as I indicated. So we're describing such things as a tumor volume doubling time, T sub D, which is not the same as the cell cycle time, the clonogen doubling time. Then there is what is called the T pot, the potential doubling time, which takes into account only the fraction, that fraction of the cells in a tumor that actually are actively proliferating, so eliminate the quiescent cells. And then there is the cell loss factor, which is the fourth element, that takes into account, as I already said, those cells that in fact die immediately after mitosis. And here are a few typical numbers. The cell cycle time is of the order of 1 to 2 days, remarkably invariant among different types of cells. The growth fraction, typical number, these numbers change, of course, from tumor to tumor. Typical number will be about 40%, and therefore the potential doubling time will be 5 days and not 1 or 2 days. Cell loss is very high in tumors, 90%, and you end up with a volume doubling time of about 60 days. Let me also say that this T pot, this quantity here, will change, can change by perhaps more than an order of magnitude going from among different tumor types. For instance, prostate tumors have a rather long, they are very slowly growing tumors, and this can be as long as maybe 60 days rather than 5 days. And these are things that have to be taken into account in the kind of calculations I'm going to describe. This is the relationship between D and B used in the stochastic equations and these quantities that can be measured. There is a very important advantage to have a model where the parameters can actually be measured independently of the model and be able to confirm that you are roughly close to what people know independently about these parameters. All right, so there are many other problems, that many other assumptions here, and for instance, cells do not progress through the cell cycle in synchrony, and this is ignored here, of course. And one can bring many objections, of which most of which we are aware of course. Now, what is it that we propose here, and what we wanted to do is to establish a link between survival time, and the event here is tumor recurrence. So we are interested in tumor recurrence or death or the detection of metastasis. So this will be what we call survival time, the absence of any of this, and we wanted to link this to the probability distribution of the number of clonogens left after a given treatment. In a cartoon way, the idea is that you design a treatment plan. As a result of the treatment, there is a certain distribution of clonogens left, which is unknown. What you actually do observe is survival as a function of time post-treatment, where, of course, survival means detecting a tumor. And having this data, and the formalism that we just described, we want to go back and try to figure out what is the probability P sub M, the distribution of clonogens left, and knowing this, go back one more time and perhaps design a better treatment. Now, when I say design a better treatment, we have only two tools that we can use. One of them is dose escalation, and the second tool is the temporal pattern in which the dose is delivered. These are the only two things we can do, and that's what we're going to play with. Now, here is, in fact, for fractionation, you can derive a rather nice analytic equation that gives you this probability P sub M of T, where this B, A, B, C, and D are just constants. They depend on the birth date, death rate, the time, and the initial number of cells. And given these numbers, you can calculate very easily, this is a rather nice analytic expression, this probability. Given that, you can set up some number, say N sub C, which is a critical number of cells necessary for the cells to be, for the tumor to be detected again. And it's probably unrealistic to assume that there is one such number, but if this was indeed the case, then in order to find probability of survival, all you have to do is do a summation from 0 to n sub c minus 1 of the probability that you end up with m clonogens. Everything above that will be a detectable tumor. Probably more realistic is to take this probability of survival expressed as a product of the distribution of clonogens at the end of the treatment times this factor, which describes the time, the cumulative distribution function of the time it takes a single clonogen to grow into a detectable tumor. So now you can make some assumption about this function. Remember that in principle you don't have to do that at all, because this formalism is self-contained, contains all the predictions about the entire evolution of the system. But in practical terms, if you actually want to do an analysis, it's better to make some parametric assumption. Just makes life a bit easier. Let's skip this. This is just an example of one such two such distributions. In fact, if you were to start with a million cancer cells, and if you take the potential time at 13 days, and if you take the cell loss factor as 80%, and if you assume a fractionation treatment of 30 fractions, here is circles starting here, the distribution of clonogens as a function of M. If the surviving fraction per fraction is 0.58, and this is what happens, the squares, if the surviving fraction is 0.50. Notice that a very small difference in the probability of survival will result in vastly different clonogenic distributions after the treatment. also, what it's calculated here, PC means probability of cure, which means the ultimate probability at time goes to infinity that you'll end up with no detectable tumor. And this is, in this case, 40%, which will be a very bad treatment, and in this case is 99%, which will be an excellent treatment. I don't think we have this kind of treatment, but what appears to be a tiny difference in survival probability can have huge consequences in terms of probability of cure, which brings up again the point that maybe there is something useful in understanding these distributions. Right, so this is the expression that I already mentioned. We decided to use a gamma distribution for the cumulative f of t. It's just a flexible enough function to accommodate many such data. And apply this to a real case to see what happens. And these are data coming from Memorial Sloan Kettering, our own hospital. It's a database containing approximately 11, well, at the time of analysis, we have had about 1,100 patients. It is customary to divide patients in three groups in terms of the outcome of radiation treatment, and these are favorable risk, intermediate risk, and unfavorable risk patients. They are divided in these groups according to, and these are empirical results, according to the PSA, prostate-specific antigen result, according to the stage of the tumor, and according to the Gleason score, which is the grade of the tumor showing how aggressive the tumor is. I should also mention that what is called here relapse, and this is defined right here, it's really looking back at the PSA, and typically immediately after the treatment, PSA goes completely down. But then if it's watched as a function of time, sometimes it will start growing up again. And if there are three successive PSA elevations, so three times you notice the PSA going up and up again, this is called, in the world of radiation oncology, biochemical failure, because PSA starts going up again. It is not known to be very strongly related to actual patient survival. The only factor that seems to be related to that is the Gleason score, which is the aggressivity of the tumor. But that is another question. But this will be the definition of relapse in this particular study. Here is the number of patients in each group, and we went through the maximum likelihood approach. This is all very standard. And furthermore, to simplify the analysis, we made the assumption that in this analysis we can indeed approximate this distribution by this Poisson expression. So we went back to the, for the sake of simplicity, to this expression. A here, this parameter, is the mean number of surviving clonogens following the treatment, and you can write these expressions. You end up with only three parameters that are identifiable from the data, from this type of analysis, and these are the mean number of clonogens and the two parameters that characterize the gamma distribution, mu, the mean, and the standard deviation. The formalism fits the data very, very well. This is one particular dose group. So the data were stratified in four different dose groups, from lower group to higher group. And this is one particular dose, just to indicate the type of fit we obtain. We compare the parametric model with a non-parametric display of the data. This is the hazard function, and indicates not only that it fits quite well the data, but notice this peak right here, and that indicates that for each of these groups there is a particular time when the risk of relapse or observing a relapse, it's higher than at any other time. This is the meaning of this particular peak. Seems to be something peculiar to the prostate, because similar analysis of the brace data does not show this kind of effect. This shows what happens. This is f of t, and indicates that there doesn't seem to be any difference in terms of the cell proliferation post-treatment among favorable, intermediate, or unfavorable groups, so they can be really put together in terms of that function f of t. Let me go and think. Running out of time, right? I don't think. I'll try. Okay. Here are some results. This is not what we are plotting here is the probability of cure as determined from this. So remember, data, you measure data at 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever. You want to know what is the ultimate probability of cure, and for that you need a model, of course. And these are the numbers shown here. Here are the dose groups that were analyzed. So this is 68.4 gray. This is really not done anymore. It's considered too low a dose. Second group, 68.4 to 72 gray, is about 74 gray. And this is going up to 86.4 gray. And for favorable patients, this is the probability of cure. It's very good. We, in fact, had no failures in this group here, so we couldn't obtain any result. Here is the intermediate group, and here is the unfavorable group. And you immediately notice, and this is known, that dose escalation plays a major role in controlling locally, having the ability to control the tumor in terms of biochemical relapse. Here is something more interesting, which is unexpected, at least it was unexpected to me, and this is the mean progression time, the mean time going to detecting a relapse. And notice that the higher the dose, the shorter the mean progression time. And this seems to be counterintuitive, but it is possible that we have a group of very fast proliferating cells that are not so much being affected by the dose escalation. And on the other hand, by increasing the dose, what we do, we destroy the slowly proliferating cells. So basically, at high dose, we select perhaps for these fast proliferating cells. In practical terms, it means that if you are in any of these groups, and if you are at the high dose end of this range, you'll know the bad news, if any, very quickly. And the other way around, of course. I wanted to show you more results from this type of analysis, and this focuses now on one particular number of fractions, 41 fractions. And using this analysis, we looked at the survival fraction per fraction, survival probability per fraction, as determined from this clinical data. So this is not in vitro data. And for each one of these groups, also at the initial number of cells, an effective number for the initial number of cells. And this seems to go up between favorable intermediate. Suddenly it goes down for unfavorable. I have no explanation for this. Something is not right here, but this is what comes out of the analysis. Interestingly enough, the differences between survival probabilities, these groups, are not actually very, very large. They can end up being significant, of course, in terms of the ultimate result. Mean progression time and probability of cure goes from about 90% down to about 35%. Now, what is it that you can do with this kind of results? Well, what you want to do is to answer the question, what kind of dose escalation can we do, for instance, in a fractionation study, to improve the outcome of this treatment? And I'll show you two graphs, and then I'll end. This shows, as a function of the number of fractions, so one way to do it is simply increase the number of fractions, go for longer treatment times, keep the same 1.8 gray per fraction, and this will be a prediction based on this analysis, purely clinical analysis, what will happen for favorable, intermediate, and unfavorable risk groups as you increase the number of fractions. So this I call horizontal dose escalation as you go in time. There is a second way that is being contemplated today, which is increasing the dose per fraction, but keeping the number of fractions fixed. And if you want to do that, you end up with this kind of curves. And to the extent that you believe in these results, you can attempt to maybe use them. This happens to be in a fixed number of fractions, 41 again. You do not know from this analysis the ratio alpha over beta, but just taking two values, 5 and 10, the difference is not that much, so it doesn't seem to be, at least in terms of these results, very sensitive to the, to this number. And this is another way of improving the probability of cure. Currently, we are using the same formalism to look at brachytherapy data. This is more complicated than fractionation, but will give us more information. Also, the possibility of combining brachytherapy and external beam therapy to take advantage of the dosimetric advantages of each one of these two modalities. So this is all I have to say, and thanks very much.